You know, it's hard to maintain a steady foot on the classic doctrine of absolute sovereignty when it seems as if the world around you is falling apart. You could feel a bit overwhelmed thinking that God has lost control. You know, I struggled with that a little bit this week as I was watching the news. I mean, here are some of the headlines. Chicago has bloodiest weekend ever. U.S. withdrawals from Afghanistan sparks fears of Taliban slaughter. Cyber wars threaten to lead to World War III. Sex and violence celebrated at the BET Awards. Delta variant spreading rapidly in U.K. Global warming leaves hundreds dead and homeless as heat waves scorch the northwest of the United States. Just an endless barrage of horror stories. Reminded me of just how dark and frightening our world could be. The world seems to be burning up and man seems to have lost his way. Amidst this backdrop, it's so easy to forget that this is God's world and that he is in charge. Well, in our story this morning, we meet a lady named Hannah. Hannah is living during a time of social upheaval while at the same time bearing under the weight of our own problems. But in the midst of it all, Hannah has not lost sight of God, nor of the fact that no matter how things may seem, God is still in control. He's still in charge. So let's look at this story, right? I mean, if you know anything about 1 and 2 Samuel, you'll know that this book records one of the darkest periods in Israel's life. This period is often referred to as the Book of Judges, which concludes with this summary. In those days, there was no king, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, such statements find resonance in our own time. You see, in this increasingly secular culture, most people no longer believe that there is any fixed moral standard that they need to obey. Instead, the spirit of this age could be summed up in these phrases. Find your own truth. Follow your heart. Do what makes you happy. They say that this is the best way to human flourishing. But is it? Because the lesson is plain. You know, when everyone is a law unto themselves, their lawlessness reigns. It's because of the corruption of our human nature. People are always seeking freedom to do as they please. And whatever they choose to do, they tend to call it either right or good. Mark Sayers picks this up in his book, The Vertical Self, when he describes this generation as having unprecedented personal freedom. But that freedom is often accompanied by a haunting sense of being lost. Without a shared sense of morals and values, what this has led to is a crisis of meaning within our culture, where without God, we are becoming increasingly spiritually malnourished. Has anyone else noticed the rise in racial tensions? I mean, what about the spike in suicides, or the rise of the crisis of leaderships, the breakdown of the family, or the surge of violent crimes? We're celebrating our pride in being a post-Christian nation, but have we actually lost our way without Christ? Hannah knows what it's like to live through these times of moral relativism where there is no longer a fixed cultural presupposition of right or wrong, true or false, good or bad. And Hannah couldn't escape the reality of her times, even in the house of God, especially with spiritual leaders like Hophni and Phinehas, who the Bible describes as greedy scoundrels who did whatever they wanted, slept with whomever they wanted, and showed utter contempt for the things of God. Oh, and their poor father, Eli, was not considered a bad man, but neither was he firm enough to call out his son's failures. Eli had failed miserably in leading his family, and in so doing, he failed miserably in leading the nation, something that we as Christian leaders in the church need to be aware of here in the 21st century, because this is the result of what happens when leaders lack courage and conviction. If anything, is going to change for Hannah in her situation, it's going to take divine intervention. It's going to take a miracle. And that's exactly what God is going to do. The books of 1 and 2 Samuel were written around 1050 BC, and they were originally compiled as a single book. Ryan Kelly, in his commentary on Samuel, calls this book a hinge book because it marks a pivotal transition between the dark period of the judges to that of the monarchs and kings of Israel. And what you'll notice and really ought to pay attention to is what these transitions teach us about God. Because this book is all about God and God's solution to the moral and leadership crisis in Israel. And that solution is God's humble king. And this search for God's humble king in Samuel is what provides the structure for the entire book. I mean, it's held together by three poems that arrive at significant moments in the story. The first poem is Hannah's Song, chapter 2, verses 1 through 11, which is pre-king, but yet it's still all about God's chosen king. Then you have 2 Samuel 1, 17 to 27, which is David's song after the death of Saul and Jonathan. And the final one is David's final song towards the end of 2 Samuel in chapter 22. And what each of these songs have in common is that they're all about how God opposes the proud, how he exalts the humble, and how, despite tragedies and human evil, God is working out his purposes in history. God is in charge. And what we'll discover is that the solution to all the problems we see in Samuel is actually pointing to God's solution for the whole world. It's God's humble king. He is the one who is going to come and make things right by turning the world upside down. He's not going to do it in the way that we expect, but through the feeble, the weak, the desolate, and the barren. But we're not there just yet. So in order for us to appreciate where this story is going, we must first see how God is unfolding his plan in these first two chapters. And so what I want us to see in these chapters is a certain man of God, a woman's cry to God, and an incomparable God. Verse 1 starts out with these words. There was a certain man. And this certain man is later identified as Elkanah from the hill country of Ephraim. Now, here are three things we ought to notice about Elkanah. His obscurity. Elkanah is from Rephaim Zuphin, a small backwater town that nobody heard of, with a genealogy that didn't wield much social or political power within the nation. He's from a nowhere place, from a nowhere clan. So why is this certain man important? Because this is the first hint of a theme that will develop in the course of 1 Samuel. The solution to Israel's crisis is not going to come from the ruling class. He will not be the child of a super rich banker or have a genealogy full of aristocrats and oligarchs from Mayfair or Chelsea. The solution to Israel's problem will come from the hill country of Ephraim. A small nowhere place with no real social standing, no claim to fame or power within the nation. And that's the point, that God is going to turn things around, not in the ways that we would expect. Because this book is about a God who makes something out of nothing. He brings life out of death. He makes the rich poor and the poor rich. He makes somebodies out of nobodies. And Elkanah's importance is in his unimportance, because that's how God works. And then we notice his devotion. He's described as a devoted man. Verse 3, year after year, he went up to the temple to worship God and to make sacrifices. And then thirdly, we notice that he was a family man with family problems. So we read in verse 2 that Elkanah not only had one wife, but two, Hannah and Peninnah. And this provides the context to Hannah's misery that we'll see later on in the chapter. It also highlights just how polygamy made family life difficult during those times. Polygamy was something that was common in those days, and most men married two wives for various reasons. The Bible never really condemns it, but it never encourages it as well. Much of the polygamy we read about in scriptures is descriptive and not prescriptive. God made it clear in Genesis 2 that he made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Eve and Eve. And whenever we read stories about polygamy, it's never portrayed in a good way. But this made family life for him difficult because, as we'll read, he tended to love Hannah, his first wife, more than Peninnah. And then we'll notice in this chapter is a woman's cry to God. Now, it's at this point in the story where the spotlight is on Hannah. I mean, Hannah, as we noted, was barren. And even though she was loved by her husband, Elkanah, she could not give him a child. And Peninnah, being aware of how much Elkanah loved Hannah, would provoke Hannah. Verse 6. Now imagine the scene, right? It's the meal after the yearly sacrifice in verse 5. And this was supposed to be a time of celebration and remembering that all that God has done. It was a memorial feast that God had actually commanded his people to observe in Deuteronomy chapter 12. And I can just imagine Peninnah saying to Hannah, "Hannah, what are you thankful for this year? You know, I'm thankful for all the children that the Lord gave me. Hannah, do you wish you had children?" "Oh, that's right. You can't. Come now, children, eat your food. By the way, Hannah, did I tell you that I was pregnant again?" And the Bible says that this went on year after year, this kind of provoking. Peninnah baiting Hannah, irritating her, winding her up until she started crying. So what's with Hannah's barrenness anyway? And why does this seem crucial to the story? Well, one, Hannah's barrenness should cause us to raise questions of God's blessings. You remember in Deuteronomy chapter 7, the Lord tells his people that if you are careful to obey my laws, there will be no one barren among you. But Hannah is barren. Where's the blessing? Is this God's judgment? Hannah's troubles may seem private and personal, but they also seem symbolic of the whole nation's troubles. Hannah is in need of life, but so is the nation of Israel. But then you look at Hannah's situation more closely and you realize that, hey, wait a minute. I heard this story before. Genesis 11, Sarah was barren. God performed a miracle and gave her a child in her old age. Jacob's wife, Rachel, was barren, but God listened to her and opened her womb, and she bore Joseph in Genesis 29. And more recently, at least from the standpoint of 1 Samuel, a woman was barren in Judges 13 and had no children. She was visited by an angel and promised a son. And this son was Samson, who God raised up to deliver Israel from the Philistines. And in the New Testament, you have Elizabeth, who was barren in her old age, but God gave her a child who would become the forerunner to Christ. You see, each of these women shared a sadness with Hannah, but in each case, a child was born who was God's answer to the crisis of the time. So as you're reading this story, you can't help but think that God is up to something and that this story is bigger than Hannah. So after the meal, we read where she is being provoked by Peninnah in her husband's attempt to provide meaningful consolation. We read that Hannah got up from the table in verse 9, and she goes into the temple to pray. Unaware of Eli's peering, suspicious eyes, she begins to cry out to God. You know, sometimes tears themselves constitute prayer. Psalm 6:8 says that, "For the Lord hears the sounds of our weeping." And that's what she's bringing before God now. The author describes her as being deeply distressed and bitter of soul in verse 10. She is without hope. She is without strength. But she turns to the only one who who she knows could save her. She cries out to the Lord of her hosts, verse 11. Now, what's interesting is that this is the first time that this term is used in the Old Testament. The NIV translates it, the Lord Almighty. But this word host means God of heaven armies. So essentially, she's starting her praying by saying, the God who fights for me. She's saying, look upon your servant's misery and remember me and not forget your servant, but give her a son. Then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor will ever be used on his head. Did you catch that? Notice her cry was not just for herself, but for a child to be used by God. Why? It's obvious that Hannah's visits to Shiloh weren't just painful because of Peniah's taunts. Hannah was brought face to face with problems far more urgent than those of her domestic life. There she saw with her own eyes the degrading temple practices, the blatant self-seeking of the younger priests and their abuses of power and the contempt of the Lord's offering. She realizes that the nation's problems were much greater than hers. At this point, her sorrow about her childlessness became wholly reoriented. It no longer revolved around the pleasure of a child, but around the desire for God's glory. Hannah is crying out for a child to be the man that God uses to put things right in her time. That's what she really wants. She wants a revival. She wants the glory of the Lord to once again fall upon his people. You know, when was the last time you looked around at the state of the church? Does the state of the church grieve your heart? When was the last time you looked around at the state of the church and its complacency and its weaknesses to stand against the culture? Do you cry out to God? Do you cry out to God for its failed leadership and for those who are victims of it? And are you willing to pray like Hannah? God, use me for your glory. Use me, Lord, to help make things right in my time, and to restore the honor of your great name. Because the answer to a world swimming in a sea of moral relativism is the power and glory of God returning to his church. Hannah didn't know what to do. She didn't have the answer. So she turned to the only one who had the power to save. What does God do in verse 20? Well, we read that in the course of time, Hannah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. And she named him Samuel because she said, I asked the Lord for him. So why was Hannah's prayer granted? Was it because of her sincerity? No. Was it because she was the most miserable of women in Israel at the time? Not likely. Or was it because she made an extraordinary vow to God? Certainly not. 1 Samuel is not primarily about Hannah, no more than it is primarily about a certain man from Ramatham Zophim. Samuel is mainly about God and his care for his people. And what he did for Hannah would turn out to be what he does for Israel. This story is about God. And finally, we have an incomparable God. Now, this story begins with Hannah weeping, and it ends with Hannah singing. The social and political crisis and the moral upheaval of our time are not compared to this incomparable God. It is the character and actions of God that provide the lyric for this song that she is singing. And it's launched by an intensely personal experience of God. I mean, notice the personal pronouns in verse 1. My heart rejoices in the Lord, and in the Lord my horn is lifted up. Whereas her first prayers were centered around her troubles in chapter 1, verse 8, now the Lord was the focus of her heart's confidence and joy. Her eyes are no longer fixed on the problems, but on the problem solver. And from this place of reorientation, she launches into a prayer that orbits around God himself. And at the core of this prayer was an appreciation for the utter uniqueness of God. Verse 2 reads, there is no one like you. There is no rock like our God. And this was the same prayer of Moses after the Exodus, where he prays, who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, glorious and awesome in deeds, doing wonders? Hannah now know, as the nation of Israel, who came out of Egypt, that there is nothing to compare to the Lord. There is no power. There is no one, no circumstance, no thing. He is the incomparable God. And not only that, but he is the God of knowledge. Verse 3, do not keep talking so proudly or let your mouth speak arrogance. For the Lord is a God who knows, and by him deeds are weighed. Hannah certainly had her rival in mind in these verses, but she also saw Peniah as a representation of all who are proud and arrogant in this world. And the solution to that pride is acknowledging that there is only one who knows all. And next to him, we know nothing. That's why the answer to our problems in our world is not to look within us, but to look up. It's to look to Christ, because he knows all, and in the end, all our actions are weighed by him. And then notice this incredible catalog of reversals in verses 4-8. I mean, these are the themes that we're going to see all throughout the book of Samuel. She says that the bows of the warriors are broken, and those who were full hire themselves out for food. Those who were barren now have children. It's the Lord who brings life and he brings death. He sends poverty and wealth. He humbles and he exalts. He lifts the needy from the ashes. Here we see this incomparable God who has the power to turn the world upside down. Who can reverse every human circumstance completely? Which is what God is going to do throughout this book. We're going to see that the mighty will fall, Saul. The humble will be exalted, David. And the barren will once again flourish, Israel, under David's leadership. This book is going to tell of remarkable sequences in which these great reversals happen. Let me ask you a question. Do you believe in the God of the great reversals? Do you believe in Hannah's God? Do you believe that God can turn your situation around? Do you believe that God will one day make everything right? Well, in verse 8, Hannah states that why believing in this God must radically transform everything about our attitudes about the world around us. She says, because the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. In other words, he is the creator who established the world and sustains its existence. God is in charge. And in the end, he wins. Verse 9, he will guard the feet of his faithful servants, but the wicked will be silenced in the place of darkness. For it is not by strength that one prevails. It is not by our wisdom and it is not by our clever ideas, but it's God who will give strength to his people. In the final verse, Hannah speaks of God's providential solution to the whole world. And it's full of eschatological significance. This God is the creator of all things, and he knows all things, and by whom all things are weighed will certainly judge the ends of the earth. Hannah is no longer looking at the needs of her people, Israel, but now she's looking to the needs of the whole world. It's interesting that Hannah should speak now of God's king at a time when there was no king in Israel. The prayer itself points to the source of her insight, the God who knows all. Because not only does she speak of God's chosen king, but she calls that king anointed. Hannah could not have known who the Lord's Messiah king was to be. And in that sense, this prayer is also a prophecy. Anointed may be the last word in this prayer, but it's certainly pointing to something that's coming. It's anticipating something in the future. Anointed in Hebrew is the word Messiah, one set apart who represents God's lordly rule and saving presence among his people. The meaning of this word will be fully expressed in Jesus, not in David, who foreshadows Christ, and certainly not in the kings that we read about in Chronicles and in the book of Kings. This title anointed, which in the Greek is translated Christ, belongs to Jesus. He is the one on whom we are to set all of our hopes and prayers. He is the king who humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. He is the solution to the problems, not only in our own lives, but in our world. So how do we respond to this king? We respond like Hannah, by turning to him in times of trouble, and by acknowledging that all power and authority belongs to him, that no matter what things might look like, he is in control. He is in charge. Amen.